Welcome. This is Dr. Philip E. Stieg, professor and chairman of the Department of Neurological Surgery at the Weill Medical College of Cornell University, New York Presbyterian Hospital. And I'd like to welcome you to How to Save Your Life. This week, it is my pleasure to introduce Dr. Matthew Fink, professor and vice chairman, the Department of Neurology at the Weill Medical College, Cornell University, New York Presbyterian Hospital. Today, we are going to talk about a topic of great interest and concern, dementia. For those of you who have said to a loved one, "You're losing your mind," please stay with us and learn how to deal with this situation when it is real. Hello, and welcome to How to Save Your Life. I'm Dr. Philip Stieg, and today I'm talking with Dr. Matthew Fink, Professor and Vice Chairman of the Department of Neurology at Weill Cornell Medical College. Welcome, Dr. Fink.
Thanks for inviting me, Phil. Glad to be here.
I think we'd like to start off with educating our listeners on what does a neurologist really do? Sometimes they're confused with neurosurgeons. What is the difference?
I think more often we're confused with psychiatrists than neurosurgeons. Most people know what a neurosurgeon does. You guys cut. What we do is a little more subtle. We do a lot of diagnostic work, trying to really figure out what causes a whole range of strange symptoms that people may get who have neurological disorders. And then, once we figure out what they have, our treatments really revolve around medications, rehabilitation, or sometimes referring to folks like you who have to do neurosurgery.
So more specifically, can you outline for the public what diseases does the neurologist actually deal with?
The most common things that we deal with turn out to be common problems that a lot of family doctors deal with. So for example, headaches, backaches, low back pain, neck pain are probably the most common things that we see. Fortunately, most of those problems are relatively harmless, benign things. They get better, don't result in any major problems. But then we do deal with a variety of very, very serious problems. Dementia that you mentioned earlier is one of them. Stroke is a major problem. Dementia and stroke are the two most common serious neurological disorders that we deal with. But then if we go down the list of other things, we take care of patients who have epilepsy, multiple sclerosis, muscular dystrophy problems, damage to the nerves, for example, patients who have diabetes, who develop conditions called neuropathy, are things that we take care of. So there's a whole range of disorders. And again, they can be complicated just in terms of diagnosis as well as treatment.
I think for the public out there, probably stroke is one of the most frightening things that they have to deal with. I don't think there's anybody I know that doesn't have a relative that's had a stroke. Can you describe what happens in a stroke?
Well, you're right. A stroke is, you know, one of the most feared problems. And I see a lot of patients who come in and say to me, "Doc, I'd rather be dead than have a stroke. My greatest fear is being stuck in a wheelchair, in a nursing home, unable to communicate, unable to work, unable to be with my family." And that's often what happens with a stroke. So the term stroke really goes back to Old English. People were stricken down suddenly. The early descriptions were someone who suddenly collapsed on the street unconscious due to a stroke. And the cause for that is the sudden death of part of the brain as the result of some abnormality of the blood vessels of the brain. So a blood vessel either will be suddenly closed off or it will burst. And either way, it causes severe sudden damage to the brain, which then causes the symptoms of a stroke.
Is there anything that we can do to protect ourselves from these kinds of things before this devastating thing could happen?
Well, there are a whole variety of what we refer to as risk factors that will predispose one to have a stroke. The one that most people are familiar with is high blood pressure. And most people do understand that high blood pressure can cause a blood vessel to burst. Not a hard thing to understand. Blood vessels are like hoses, and if the pressure inside of your garden hose is going to be too high, then the hose is going to burst and you're going to have a leak. If that happens in the brain, then you really are facing a catastrophe because of blood under high pressure bleeding into the brain tissue. So high blood pressure is the single most important and treatable risk factor to prevent a stroke. And the statistics are somewhat chilling, even in the United States. We feel that in our country, most people have access to good health care, but the statistics show that only about 2/3 of people in this country who have high blood pressure even know that they have it. And of those that know that they have high blood pressure, only about half are being adequately treated. So what that tells us is that there are literally millions of people in the United States who are not having their blood pressure adequately treated, who are at risk for having a stroke.
So you're saying that when a patient sees their family doctor, they need to be more proactive about this? Or how can we improve those numbers?
Some people don't see a family doctor. Some people still don't go to see doctors at all. They wait until they get sick before they go to a doctor. So it means that people should get a checkup once in a while to see if they have high blood pressure.
What's a once in a while? You think once a year?
I think for a healthy person, you can go every 2 to 3 years. If you have no known medical problems, I don't think you have to go once a year. Every couple of years is fine. But to give you an example, we did a screening in the neighborhood around their hospital, and our hospital is on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, which is an affluent neighborhood. Everyone has access to doctors. We just did a general screen of the people in this neighborhood and found that 15% of them had high blood pressure, whether they were being treated or not. And that isn't a population of people that certainly can get whatever health care they want. So if you extrapolate that to the rest of the country, or quite frankly, to the rest of the developing world, it is a huge, huge public health problem.
So we as doctors and as patients out there, they just need to do a better job at trying to get their blood pressure under control. Are there other things that they can try to control?
Certainly. A lot of the common problems that we're trying to deal with related to prevention of heart disease are the same risk factors that increase the risk of having a stroke. Obesity, lack of physical exercise, high blood cholesterol, all are risk factors for stroke and are all treatable conditions. Cigarette smoking, which still is a huge problem, although fortunately getting better, is a major risk factor for strokes of all types. So a variety of problems that can only be changed by changes in behavior, really.
So we've got the ideal person out there. I'm going to go out and I'm going to take care of all of these things. What's my chance of still going on and having the big stroke?
Well, then it depends on your family history. What are your genetics? Does stroke run in the family? Have your parents live to age 100 as opposed to dying of a stroke or heart attack at age 50. All of those things enter into it. But if you or anyone else deals directly with the risk factors and you eliminate the risk factors, we would estimate that we can reduce the risk of stroke anywhere from 50% to 80% just by dealing with the risk factors that can be changed. So you can have a huge impact on this and really have a tremendous effect on your health and longevity.
So that's astounding. We can reduce 80% of the strokes that we see by just getting people to behave.
Well, not just by getting them to behave. I'm not sure how you would define behave, but certainly by identifying what are the causes, what are the risk factors, and changing them.
So we've done all that, and you know, I still go on and have my major stroke. What does the family have to prepare themselves for when someone comes home with a stroke?
Well, one reason I got interested in this field is from some of my own experiences, and I'll answer that question by giving you a story. I grew up in inner city Philadelphia, and I lived in a row house, and I had neighbors on either side of me. You could hear them talk, and one neighbor was a middle-aged guy who used to scream at his kids all the time, day and night. Day and night, I heard him screaming at his kids, you know, be quiet, stop playing ball in the living room. And day and night, I would hear the guy scream. And then one day, it got quiet. Didn't hear him screaming anymore. Everything got very quiet, and I was saying, gee, what happened? Well, looked out the window, an ambulance pulled up to his house and took him away. He had a stroke. And his stroke stopped him from talking. He developed what we call an aphasia. So he went to the hospital. He came back from the hospital.
Can you define what's an aphasia?
Aphasia is a disorder where you lose the ability to speak or have some impairment in your ability to speak. So he had a stroke. It affected his speech. Took him to the hospital. When he came back, he wasn't yelling at his kids anymore. And I thought this was just terrific. I now had a nice, you know, quiet next-door neighbor. However, it affected his family profoundly. I mean, he was no longer able to go to work. His family had terrible financial problems, and it had a really, really devastating effect on his family and his children and their ability to go on.
That's a grim picture. But are there any support structures out there where people can go to get help, or is it as bad as all that?
Well, the first thing is we kind of didn't talk about the treatment for these things. So, I mean, strokes can be serious, but we also have the ability to treat them. And, you know, the example I gave you growing up was before there was any treatment for a stroke. Now, if someone like that came to our hospital with a stroke of that effect, we would have been able to treat him, I think, quite effectively with a very high chance of reversing that and, in fact, getting him better so that he would go home to his family in a much better state than he was at that time. So there are a lot of things we can do now to change things.
Why don't we take a little bit of time then to talk about how you might want to treat those problems?
Well, as I said earlier, you know, there are two kinds of strokes. One is the kind where a blood vessel in the brain is blocked off and it causes death to the brain tissue. Well, that can be treated by reopening the blood vessel. And that's done with either what we refer to as clot-busting drugs, on the one hand, that can be administered, or with a procedure where a little plastic tube, a catheter, can be passed up into the blocked blood vessel, and that blood clot can be pulled out. And we can do that in quite a few patients, and that can completely reverse the effects of the stroke. In the case of a burst blood vessel bleeding into the brain, then neurosurgeons as yourself and your colleagues are able to treat those with surgery, with an operation, or by using other procedures to seal off the bleeding blood vessel.
Dr. Fink, it's been an interesting discussion about stroke, but I wanted to focus a little bit more now on when a patient does have a massive brain injury from either stroke or a bad car accident or something of that nature, is there impact on other parts of the body other than just the brain?
Absolutely, yes. The brain is, in many ways, the master organ. And
so we can say the brain rules?
The brain rules, absolutely. But it has an impact on every function of the body. Every other organ system is affected. The ones that are most prominently affected during massive brain injury are the heart. And in fact, having a serious brain injury can induce a heart attack, even in a perfectly young, healthy person who's not had any heart disease. So brain injury can cause a heart attack. It can affect most other organs in the body in a very significant way. The flip side of that is that other organs in the body can affect brain function. So, for example, if you have heart failure where the heart is not pumping enough blood to the brain, that can deprive the brain of oxygen and can affect brain function. So I guess we're going to talk about dementia. One of the causes of dementia, in fact, is heart failure, where the brain suffers from a lack of oxygen, and that can affect your memory, it can affect your ability to do arithmetic, and it can affect your ability to read and write. So there is a constant interplay between brain function and other organ systems.
Well, with that, it's time to take a short break. This is Dr. Philip E. Stieg, professor and chairman of the Department of Neurological Surgery at the Weill Medical College of Cornell University, New York Presbyterian Hospital. Don't go anywhere. We'll have more time with Dr. Matthew Fink, professor and vice chairman of neurology at Weill Cornell Medical College. Welcome back to How to Save Your Life. I'm Dr. Philip Stieg, and I'm talking with Dr. Matthew Fink, Professor and Vice Chairman of the Department of Neurology at Weill Medical College, Cornell University, New York Presbyterian Hospital. Dr. Fink, you know, we've talked about the massive acute injury, but then there's the slower type of injury that you referred to as dementia. You know, frequently we're sitting across a dinner table and we think somebody is a little bit nuts or demented. You know, have you ever seen that? Have you been out with your friends?
Well, across the dinner table, usually it means that they had too much to drink when that happens. And I'm not sure that we want to call that dementia, but certainly we've all had that experience. The term is a difficult term, and I know most people that I speak to don't like the term. Dementia, most people think of as someone who has developed, you know, antisocial behavior or is almost criminal in a lot of ways. But again, it's an old term. What it strictly means is that there is a loss of neurological cognitive functions that otherwise the person had in the past. So, for example, you begin to slowly lose your memory. You begin to slowly have a change of personality. That really is what we're talking about when we talk about dementia. And unfortunately, a large number of people, as they get older, will develop dementia from a variety of causes.
Well, you and I are both baby boomers, so we're sitting here terrified of having this become a problem. And you know, I'm dealing with it in my own family. Are there things that we can start doing now to help prevent it?
Well, I think that we're just starting to understand what some of the causes of dementia are. One of the most common, in fact, is something we talked about earlier, stroke. Someone who has multiple small strokes will often develop dementia due to a progressive loss of cognitive functions, and that can be prevented by doing all the things we spoke about to prevent stroke. But there's another interesting wrinkle to this whole field. Many of the risk factors that cause a heart attack and stroke are related to the development of a condition we know as Alzheimer's disease. Alzheimer's disease is the most common form of dementia, and we believe that it is caused by the deposition of a toxic chemical in the brain called amyloid. Amyloid comes from the bloodstream. It's produced by the liver. It circulates in the blood, and it leaks into the brain through the blood vessels in the brain. So therefore, if we can do things to maintain the blood vessels in the brain, prevent them from becoming leaky, it probably will reduce the risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. So therefore, the things I spoke about earlier, not smoking, treating high blood pressure, treating your high cholesterol, dealing with diet and obesity problems, all of those things which help to maintain the integrity of blood vessels in the brain will reduce the risk of getting Alzheimer's disease. So we can do a lot to help ourselves and prevent these things.
One of the things that we're being bombarded with on TV and the radio is, you know, everybody's worried about short-term memory loss, which is obviously part of the dementia picture. But there are medications that are out there. You know, what do those medications do, and how effective are they in treating this problem?
Well, the pharmaceutical companies will hate me for this, but my experience and the experience of most neurologists who take care of patients is that that whole collection of medicines out there that are being marketed for treatment of Alzheimer's disease do very, very little. They have been approved by the Food and Drug Administration based on scientific studies which showed, you know, quote, a statistically significant difference from placebo. However,
and a placebo being
a sugar pill.
Yeah.
However, it doesn't have a meaningful effect on patients. So I rarely prescribe those medications. They're very expensive. They do very little. They have side effects. And unfortunately, I think that there's been so much advertising about these medications to the general public that they have, you know, developed the idea that these medicines have a significant benefit, and they really don't. So They've been over-advertised.
So it's a little bit hopeless in the sense of once the process has started, there isn't a medication that we provide, there aren't any surgical treatments. Are there any forms of help? Can they get any type of therapy, any memory tricks that patients can learn to try to help them get through the day as they start to notice their memory going and also their family members?
Yeah. Well, first of all, there are other conditions which can cause dementia or loss of memory, and some of them can be treated with surgery. There's a disorder which has gotten a lot of publicity recently called normal pressure hydrocephalus, where there is a buildup of fluid within the cavities of the brain, and that can result in memory impairments, problems with walking, and oddly enough, problems in controlling bladder function and urination. And that is a condition which can be treated with a very simple surgical procedure, a plumbing procedure, where you insert a little tube into the ventricles in order to allow fluid to drain, and that's a treatable condition.
And the ventricles being the fluid chambers within the brain.
The fluid chambers within the brain. So there are some things, are some disorders that can be treated that way. But there is very good evidence that mental exercise, as physical exercise helps your muscles and your strength and your balance, mental exercises can prevent you from deteriorating, can prevent you from developing cognitive impairments. And those mental exercises are things like social interactions, spending time with other people, having, you know, meetings, conversations, playing cards, playing chess, checkers, reading, attending book clubs and book discussions. Everything that you can possibly do to stimulate the brain and do what are essentially mental exercises can preserve your cognitive functions and can prevent you from deteriorating. So it's very, very important. I mean, the expression, you know, use it or lose it applies to every part of your body, not just physical things, but mental capacities as well.
So it sounds like in a number of the diseases that you as a neurologist deal with, stroke and dementia, one of the major things you have to do with the patient is try to get them to behave and do things that are healthy for themselves, change their diet, stop smoking, increase their exercise, stimulate their brain. How hard is that?
It's very hard. You have to be a Marine drill sergeant. Every time they come in to see me in the office, I hammer away at them. You know, did you stop smoking yet? Did you lose weight yet? Did you go on a diet? I mean, it is very intensive treatment to just get people to do this. And unfortunately, we fail quite often. The greatest difficulties I've found have been in trying to get people to stop smoking. Very, very difficult. And to change their diets, the two most difficult things. People love to take pills. I mean, they keep saying, doctor, can't you give me a prescription for something? Even to stop smoking. Can you give me a prescription to help me stop smoking? Well, I mean, there are treatments out there where we do write prescriptions, but the bottom line is you just have to have the willpower to do it, to just stop. There is no simple way to do it. So it is very difficult to get people to change their habits, especially lifelong habits.
The other thing that doesn't really get focused upon in the dementia category, again, is not only the individual that has dementia, but the family and loved ones that are around the individual. Do you have any advice for them in terms of how to cope with it, how to help themselves and the person that has dementia, how to deal with that and the psychological impact and the family stressors?
Yeah, it's a very, very difficult problem. And it's handled differently in different cultures. There's an interesting difference, for example, between Western American families and Eastern families, for example, Chinese families. We're very quick to put grandma in a nursing home, which, quite frankly, is one of the worst things you could do, because if you take someone who's developing cognitive problems and you take them out of a familiar environment and put them in a strange environment, they will get worse. I mean, that completely throws them off. So the best thing to do is to keep people in a familiar environment, and the best way is within their family. So the Chinese have multi-generational families. They have, You know, grandma, grandpa, mother and father, children, grandchildren, you know, three or four generations of one family living together in the same home, and they actually help each other. One of the best things to help an old person to focus and orient is for that person to have contact with young children. One of the best things possible. When my children were 3 and 4 years old, I used to take them to the hospital with me to make rounds in the hospital. And I actually used to tell them, as I made rounds, I would sit each of them in a room with one of the elderly patients and just spend time with them. I say, you know, sit here and just, you know, entertain Mrs. Smith while I'm going around, because it has an amazingly beneficial effect on old people that are developing cognitive problems. To have them spend time with young children, it's almost as if it, you know, wakes up a part of the brain that has been, you know, sleeping for years. So, very beneficial thing. Unfortunately, in the United States, we don't do that. We separate everybody. We have the grandchildren, you know, over here. They never visit the grandparents or the great-grandparents who are stuck in a nursing home or an assisted living facility. And it really is beneficial for all the generations to actually spend time together. Now, I'm sort of going against the trend of things in the United States, but my own experience has been that that is an extremely beneficial thing.
I would agree totally. I remember when my children were younger, I used to round with them and push them around in a wheelchair, and they had a great time in the wheelchair. But the patients would immediately lighten up when I brought them into the room with them. It was a delightful experience for both involved. Let's switch topics and flip over to epilepsy, another major problem that you deal with as a neurologist. Can you tell me what epilepsy is?
Well, epilepsy is a disorder where there's actually a short circuit that occurs in the brain. The brain, if you get down to it at a microscopic level, is an electrical chemical organ. You've got electrical discharges going off and chemicals being released. And if there is some type of a error that occurs, you get a short circuit in the electrical impulses, then you'll get a generalized discharge of electricity throughout the brain, which then causes an epileptic seizure. And most people have seen this happen. Someone loses consciousness, falls down, shakes all over, they may foam at the mouth, and that's an epileptic seizure. It's a horrible thing to observe. It's worse for the person having the seizure. When they recover from this, they feel absolutely awful. And it can kill someone. People die from these things. It's a very, very serious thing. They're extremely common. The statistics are that at some time during your life, we all have one chance out of 25 of having an epileptic seizure. 4% of the population at some time or another may have an epileptic seizure. We're all potentially at risk for having a seizure depending on the circumstances.
But the good news is that the vast majority of these are treatable.
Absolutely.
Okay. So even though we're at relatively high risk, our lives won't be significantly changed by them.
Well, I'm trying to drum up business for the neurologist, so I just want everybody to know how common all these problems are.
But the point being that you can treat them how? Do they need medication, or will they go away on their own?
Well, after someone has their first seizure, they have really probably a 50 to 60% chance of never having a second. So most people don't need treatment or even have to go on medications. But there's a smaller group that does, that has to be treated with medications. And then there are some patients who can, in fact, be treated with surgery. If there is a particular little part of the brain that is functioning abnormally and is causing the seizure, that can be removed. And that, in fact, will cure the seizures, cure the epilepsy. So this is a very, very treatable condition, and there are very few people that really fail treatment. Just about everybody can be effectively treated.
In the earlier times, epileptics were kind of categorized and isolated off into the corners. I mean, that isn't the case anymore. People can lead a completely normal life with the diagnosis of epilepsy or a seizure disorder.
Absolutely. And there are millions of people who, in fact, have it. You don't know that they have it because they're perfectly healthy, normal people. and they generally would not discuss it with you. They may take medication, or they may have had surgery, and they're fine now.
Are there certain things that you can do to reduce your tolerance or increase the risk for having a seizure?
Well, there is. The one thing people should be careful about is extreme lack of sleep. Any of us, if we go without sleep for a prolonged period of time, could run the risk of that triggering an epileptic seizure. The other thing is too much alcohol. A lot of alcohol can trigger it. And then, unfortunately, a lot of the street drugs, drugs of abuse on the street, are a big problem. The most common one is cocaine, which can kill people by causing seizures.
So thus far, as a neurologist, you've said that patients can't have any fun except for sleeping a lot.
Well, I didn't say anything about they can't have sex. That's okay.
And that doesn't lower your threshold
no,
for having seizures.
I don't know anything bad that sex can do to you, so that's perfectly okay, as much as you want.
That's good. Is there a more common problem of seizures in young or in elderly, or does it strike all ages?
Well, it occurs more commonly in the very young, in infants, and then in the very elderly. So in some ways, in many ways, we kind of start out as infants and we end up as infants.
Again, it's time to take a short break. Don't go away. We'll have more with Dr. Matthew Fink. I'm Dr. Philip Stieg, and you are listening to How to Save Your Life. Welcome back to How to Save Your Life. I'm Dr. Philip Stieg, and I am talking with Dr. Matthew Fink, Professor and Vice Chairman of the Department of Neurological Surgery. It's an extreme pleasure to have Dr. Fink with us today. He is an honored individual in the world of neurology. I want to bring you up to date in terms of his background. He went to the University of Pennsylvania, did his medical training at the University of Pittsburgh, and his neurologic training at Boston City Hospital, and then at Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center in New York. He went on to become an attending and faculty member at Columbia, and then moved on to Albert Einstein Medical College, and eventually became president and chief executive officer of Beth Israel Medical Center in New York. And thereafter, he moved back to Weill Cornell Medical Center and New York Presbyterian Hospital as professor and vice chairman of the Department of Neurology. Of interest is back in the 1980s, we will note that Dr. Fink was a leader in creating one of the first, if not the first, neurologic intensive care unit in the United States. What was going on in your mind 20 years ago that made you think that this was an important thing, which has now actually become the standard of care?
Well, it was actually a very quick and easy decision, because I remember the precise moment when I decided that's what I was going to do. I was a resident in neurology at Columbia University Medical Center at the time, and one of my patients was a 25-year-old woman who had a disorder called myasthenia gravis. Myasthenia gravis is a very rare neuromuscular disorder, which is very severe and can get to the point where your muscles are so weak that you can no longer breathe and you have to go on a breathing machine. And that's the situation that this young woman was in. She was on a breathing machine. However, she was on the neurology unit in our hospital, not in an intensive care unit. And the reason she was not in an intensive care unit, it was the opinion of doctors at the time that neurological patients were so bad off that they shouldn't waste their neurological beds or waste their intensive care unit beds on these patients because they were all going to die. So I had this 25-year-old woman who had a terrible disease that was treatable. We could treat it, and we could get her completely back to normal. And at 3 o'clock in the morning, her breathing tube got clogged, and she couldn't breathe, and she died in the middle of the night without the benefit of an intensive care unit that would have, in fact, saved her life. And this was a situation that I observed repeated over and over and over again with young people who had devastating diseases but were treatable and could get better, but they were deprived the benefit of an intensive care unit. So it was at that moment that I decided this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to devote my career to developing this type of unit and not let this kind of awful thing happen to patients like this anymore. And that's how it started.
I'm sure you were just welcomed with open arms by hospital administrators and the chairman of your department to make this expenditure and develop this humanitarian care for patients. Was it easy?
Oh, please. Give me a break. No, it was a nightmare trying to get this thing started. First of all, I had no support from anyone to do this. The hospital did not want to do it because it was going to cost them a ton of money to set this up. My colleagues in the Department of Neurology at the time did not support me because they thought it was just too much work and they didn't want to get involved having to take care of these patients. So essentially, I was told by my chairman at the time, and I give him some credit, he said, okay, if you can make this happen, go ahead. Nobody will help you. Nobody will give you any money. But if you can do it, by all means, go ahead. So that's what I did on my own, just, you know, pushed and pushed and worked a little bit at a time until we made it happen. And most of it happened by my, you know, making people feel guilty and, you know, making them feel, you know, sorry for what they had or had not done. And I used my best manipulative skills to get it done. And we finally got it done.
So this is the first time in your life you attacked an insurmountable challenge? Or, you know, what gave you the fortitude to do something like this?
That's just in my personality. I like to take on tough things and tough challenges. And I tell people I'm a fixer. I like to fix things. So if I see a problem, I never kind of give up. I never say, I can't fix that. The harder it is, then, you know, the more of a challenge it is for me to try to fix it.
So was listening to your neighbor shouting at his children in the background and trying to figure out how to fix his stroke, or?
Well, at the time, I was too young to understand that I was probably 8 years old when it happened. But certain things stay in your mind. And I remember, you know, when I was older and I started to understand what it was, I realized what happened to that man. And I think, as we all do, we incorporate these, what we think at the time are little experiences in our lives, and they accumulate, and we incorporate them into our, you know, future plans and interests, and that's really what happened with me.
With the intensive care unit, after you got it going, I mean, at what point did you know that this was actually the right thing to do, and everybody started to jump on the bandwagon? Why did it become the standard of care?
Well, by the time people started to jump on the bandwagon was 10 years later, at least, and at that point, I don't think I cared at that point whether people agreed with me or not. I mean, it was just done. I mean, I knew it was the right thing to do from the beginning. It was just the difficulty of getting things done. Unfortunately, as I've learned and we've all learned, being right is not enough. It simply is not enough. It's like they say, you know, being in love is not enough. There are practical things that you have to deal with, and just being right is not going to get the job done. So you have to deal with other things.
Do you think when patients are searching for good medical care, it's important for them to seek out a doctor that has access to a neurologic intensive care unit?
Well, I think in any complicated medical problem, you need to have good support systems and good backup. And I view the neurological intensive care unit as providing good backup for all of the doctors who are taking care of their patients. We're not the primary people that are going to initiate treatment, but we are backing up all the other doctors, and it makes a big difference.
You mentioned myasthenia gravis, the disorder of the nerves and muscle junctions. What other types of diseases need to have the management within a neurologic intensive care unit?
Yeah. Well, myasthenia gravis is an interesting one because today, now 25 years later, those patients don't go into intensive care units anymore. We've really figured out how to cure that disease. So they're not the ones we take care of anymore. We've moved on to other diseases, which still require a lot of work. The majority of those are really major strokes, patients that have had major episodes of bleeding into the brain, massive strokes, major head injuries, infections of the brain and spine. Those are the ones that we really have taken on now.
You mentioned head injuries. You know, the school season is starting. Kids are starting to practice football. Jeremy Shockey was just in the news for having sustained a minor concussion. Can you go into that a little bit? I mean, what is a minor concussion versus a severe concussion?
Yeah, you know, it's a very important question because these disorders are occurring in young, healthy people. They could be high school athletes, college athletes, or professional athletes. And obviously, it's a tragedy when something bad happens to someone, a young, healthy person. But a concussion is a disorder where the brain is injured from either a fall or from some type of external blow to the head. If someone's a football player, they get tackled too hard or they get hit on the head. And the trauma is enough to either cause a loss of consciousness or it simply stuns the person. So for a short period of time, they may be confused and disoriented. The most severe type of concussion, though, is one where there's a real loss of consciousness for more than a few minutes.
So I'm a parent. My son's playing football, gets his bell rung, knocked out. The football coach says, "Get back in there, boy. You know, you're a football player." What do I need to do as a parent?
Well, if you care about your kid, you will not let your son or daughter go back in and play. I mean, they have to be removed from the game, and they need to be given plenty of time to recover from that concussion. And we generally, if there's loss of consciousness like that, we generally recommend a minimum of 2 weeks of no contact sports with repeated examinations to make sure that there's no residual problems. And the residual problems we're talking about would be persistent loss of memory, trouble with cognitive functions, difficulty with doing arithmetic, reading, writing, things like that. And it's very important as a parent to pay attention to this because repeated concussions can result in permanent brain damage for someone, and you certainly are concerned about children having something like that happens to them.
there have been some prominent sport figures here in New York that, you know, have had repeated concussions. When you talk about brain damage, I mean, is it something, you know, they're still on TV, they're still talking. When we're talking about brain damage, is it something that's really going to affect their ability to function in life? Or is it minor changes that you would pick up on a neurologic exam?
The real tragedy about repeated concussions is that the effect on the brain can be delayed, so that the person who has several concussions may not realize it at the time because they're normal after they recover, but many years later can develop a progressive illness, which is dementia. And there are, you know, several examples of that. The most common is something which goes by the name of dementia pugilistica, which is a progressive dementia that occurs in boxers.
I was going to raise the issue with Muhammad Ali.
Yeah, well, Muhammad Ali developed a Parkinson's disease. Some doctors think it's due to taking too many punches as a boxer. Others do not, and I don't really know the answer to that question. But there are progressive neurological disorders that can cause dementia and can cause syndromes like Parkinson's disease because of repeated head injuries.
In the Journal of the American Medical Association, there are a number of studies, several studies that were reporting on post-traumatic stress disorder. And in this day and age where we've had tsunami and the Iraq War, which is what they were both focusing on, they talked about the neuropsychological effects of severe stress to that magnitude. Can you enlighten us on that a little bit?
Well, stress has a profound effect on virtually every physical function, every organ system, including the brain. And I don't think anybody completely understands what causes post-traumatic stress syndrome, except that it seems to be a delayed disorder where, in order to cope with some extreme physical or emotional trauma, the brain somehow suppresses the memory of this to a degree that can potentially cause some psychological harm to someone. And it isn't until later on that that kind of information is released, and it can result later on in severe depression, in longstanding anxiety disorders, which can completely disrupt your life. And some people become completely disabled. Can't go back to work, can't go back to school as a result of these things. I don't think anybody understands the actual neurochemical causes of this, but clearly the impact of it can be quite serious.
These things are real. I mean, many people, when you're sitting in a cocktail, think, oh, that person's just making that stuff up. No, these are things that you can diagnose and really potentially try to help the person, can't you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, these are not malingerers. These are people that are really suffering very severely as a result of these stresses. It can be treated. The most effective therapy that I'm aware of is what's called cognitive therapy, which is a type of talk therapy where you sit with a therapist and try to get out all of the information and review the facts, review the events, and try to get it all out in the open for discussion.
Is sleep good for this?
For treating post-traumatic stress disorder? Well, that's a good question. You probably would have some difficult dreams, I would think. So I don't know that sleep is necessarily going to make you feel any better.
But sleep is a major disease process in the United States. It's a
Lack of sleep.
Lack of sleep.
Insomnia.
Yeah, it's insomnia. A huge problem. You know, how do you go about diagnosing that problem?
Diagnosing insomnia. Well, I mean, it's a controversial area. Some sleep experts feel that insomnia as a diagnosis is overdiagnosed. And again, to get back to the prescriptions and pills, I'll make a blanket statement, which I believe is true. Billions of dollars of sleeping pills are sold, yet there has never been a scientific study that has proven that on a long-term basis, sleeping pills help you sleep better. In fact, they don't. You know, so we have millions of people taking billions of dollars of sleeping pills really for no benefit. They really don't help.
So do you think people working 2-3 jobs to help their kids get through school, is that good for them?
I don't think that's good for them. I mean, I just think in general it adds physical stress, emotional stress. I think it's unfortunate and sad that people have to do that.
Is there a quick and easy way? Since you're saying sleeping pills aren't the quick and easy way, what can I do to help myself sleep? Or is it true that we need 7-8 hours, or can you get by on 4?
Yeah, everybody is different. So everyone does not need 7 or 8 hours of sleep. In general, as you get older, you require less sleep, and that's a normal process. And the main things are to try to eliminate things which might be causing insomnia. So obvious things like eliminating caffeine, not taking things which have stimulants in them, chocolate, cigarette smoking, things like that which stimulate you. And then I think the best advice is if you can't sleep, don't stay in bed tossing and turning and worrying about it. Get out of bed and go do something else. Keep yourself busy until you're actually tired enough and your body says, now I want to go to sleep.
It's been a distinct pleasure and an honor for me to have this time to visit with Dr. Matthew Fink, Professor and Vice Chairman of the Department of Neurology at Weill Medical College, Cornell University, New York Presbyterian Hospital. Although he's taken away drugs, alcohol, and he's given us sleep, he also has given us sex. We're going to get him a next show on Howard Stern. Dr. Fink, thank you for spending this time with us.
My pleasure.